Welcome to Extraterritoriality of Dodd-Frank, a legal perspective and update. I'm Julie Schieffer, founder and editor of derivsource.com. In this podcast today, we have two leading lawyers who will give us an update on the potential extraterritorial reach of the Dodd-Frank Act. We will also be discussing how the different interpretations of provisions by the U.S. regulators may impact U.S. and non-U.S. institutions, and their cross-border activities, including trading, clearing, and reporting on swaps. With us today, we have Donna Parisi, a partner and former practice group leader of Sherman Sterling Asset Management Group, and a current member of the firm's executive group and policy committee. Ms. Parisi's practice focuses on derivatives, structured products, securitization, capital markets, and commodities matters. We also have David Lucking, who is a partner at Allen & Overy in New York. Mr. Lucking specializes in derivatives and structured finance transactions, as well as the regulatory framework that underpins the derivatives market. Mr. Lucking advises financial institutions on a wide range of derivatives products and asset classes, including credit, rates, FX, and longevity, as well as those asset classes in both funded and unfunded forms. Links to both Ms. Parisi's and Mr. Lucking's bios are going to be available via the podcast page on derivsource.com. Now let's start our discussion today with an update on the provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act that include extraterritoriality and the implications from that, and let's also look at any of the events from the last year that might have given some indication of how these provisions are evolving. Donna, do you want to start us off with a brief on this topic?
Sure, Julia. So let me just start with the basics, which is Section 772 of Dodd-Frank establishes the territorial scope of both the CFTC and SEC's jurisdiction with respect to swap activities and security-based swap activities, respectively, and they are a bit different. With respect to the CFTC, this provision provides that the provisions of Dodd-Frank shall not apply to activities outside the United States unless those activities have a direct and significant connection with the activities in or effect on commerce of the United States or contravene the CFTC anti-evasion rules. So we have a direct and significant connection type of test. In contrast, Section 772 of Dodd-Frank provides with respect to the SEC that no provision of the Securities Exchange Act of 34 shall apply to a person insofar as such person transacts business in security-based swaps without the jurisdiction of the United States unless such person transacts such business in contravention of SEC anti-evasion rules. So both of these tests do have an anti-evasion component, but the CFTC's provision also has this direct and significant connection test. You know, Julia, since the last time we've spoken, unfortunately, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of movement or guidance from either the CFTC or the SEC on how they're going to approach these extraterritorial issues. Although we do know the CFTC has made some public statements recently by Commissioner Gensler that they expect to provide an interpretation on how they're going to approach extraterritoriality sometime in the spring. And I think the industry is also bracing themselves for the CFTC and the SEC taking a different approach with respect to extraterritoriality, which will lead to its own set of complications, given that, you know, as we'll discuss in more detail later, many market participants will be duly registered and have to comply with both SEC and CFTC rules.
Okay, excellent. Now that we have an overview in the background, so thank you for that, Donna, I'd like to go into some of the specific areas of interpretation that really need to be clarified in the next year, and also if we can elaborate on their potential impact. Now, one of the areas of interpretation is the definition of a U.S. person, very simply. And David, where are we now with that definition, and where would you like us to go?
Well, Julia, we don't actually have a definition of U.S. person for purposes of the application of Title VII of Dodd-Frank. As Donna described, the provisions that relate to the jurisdictional scope of Title VII really focus on the types of activities that are being undertaken and where those activities are taking place and the connection that those activities have with the U.S., rather than limiting the scope to the entities or the people that are entering into the activities. I think it would have been helpful if Congress and the CFTC and the SEC could have interpreted their jurisdictional scope to limit it to only U.S. persons. And there have been a number of comment letters that have been submitted where people have recommended that only those transactions, for example, that are entered into with U.S. customers should fall within the scope of Dodd-Frank. But my expectation is that we're not going to end up there. Interestingly, there isn't actually a definition of U.S. person within the Commodity Exchange Act, although one of the CFTC rules does define a non-U.S. person in part it defines it as someone that is a corporation that's organized under the laws of a foreign jurisdiction or that has a principal place of business in a foreign jurisdiction. And there has been a whole body of law that has developed under Reg S in the securities context as to who might be a U.S. person under Reg S. But I think, as I said, the expectation for Dodd-Frank is really looking at the impact that the transactions have on the U.S. and the connection that those transactions have to the United States.
To underscore David's point, you know, there is some discussion and some people worry, what if you have a swaps transaction that is in fact between two persons that are clearly located outside the United States, but in fact involve an underlier that is in the U.S., let's say the S&P 500 index or something like that. It is not inconceivable at the way Dodd-Frank is drafted that the CFTC could assert you know, jurisdiction over that type of transaction simply by the fact that the underlier has a direct or significant effect on the commerce of the United States. So, you know, there is a broad spectrum of activities that can fall within that catchphrase, and David is absolutely right to sort of focus the discussion not just on who is and isn't a U.S. person, but you're going to need to think more broadly than that.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Donna. Now, let's move on to swap dealer registration. Donna, do you want to take the lead and explain to us the areas of interpretation that need to be clarified within that?
Yeah, so we do now have final rules on you know, the registration provisions and how to comply with the registration provisions. And you can go to the NFA, the National Futures Association website, and provisionally register today. The problem from an extraterritoriality perspective is that we are still waiting for product definitions, so people need to figure out if their activities in certain products bring them within these registration categories, as well as, you know, sort of the entity definitions, some more clarification and specificity on exactly what dealing activities are. And I think we expect to get those final rules and guidance prior to any CFTC guidance on extraterritoriality. So where that leaves many market participants is with the need to have to register in order to meet certain compliance dates without having any clear guidance on the extraterritorial nature of their activities. So, you know, they're going to have to make some judgment calls, and they'll probably be, you know, tend to be more conservative than not as to which entities in their corporate structure need to register given their activities and where they're located and the types of people they're dealing with, whether they're persons located in the U.S. or advisors for U.S. clients, things of that nature. So it's really putting a lot of global institutions in a bind because just as a practical matter, they're going to have to gear up and probably even, you know, start the registration process without any clear guidance on the CFTC's views on extraterritorial application. And that is going to, you know, probably lead to some unintended consequences and not such great results, in the sense that these types of institutions may very well create separate subsidiaries outside the United States to transact with non-U.S. persons to try to insulate some portion of their business from the reach of U.S. rules. And that is going to make it just more difficult and inefficient for customers to do business. Will also probably result in separate collateral pools, more difficulty in cross-margining, and basically just increased costs of doing business.
Yes, and I think to kind of add to that, as Donna says, there is a likelihood of this notion of subsidiarization because there is no guidance at the moment that large international financial institutions that potentially have branches throughout the world would be able to only register their U.S. branch or their branch that faces the U.S. swaps activity. And so if you are a large international bank with branches that are engaged in swaps activity globally, you're actually going to have to register the whole entity. And part of the registration process includes you listing the principles of the organization, and to accompany the list of principles, you have to provide fingerprint cards for senior executives at the entity that is being registered. And so you can imagine the dilemma that these large financial institutions find themselves in. Say they are headquartered out in Tokyo, they're going to have to go to their senior executives out in Tokyo and ask them to provide copies of their fingerprints in order to comply with the U.S. registration requirement, which obviously is at least difficult for the people that are going to be making that request and obviously very difficult generally from a kind of administrative perspective.
It sounds like there's quite a lot more to iron out in that area specifically. But moving on to trading via execution facilities such as CEFs, David, do you want to give us your perspective on how this should be clarified going forward?
Yes. So we've heard from both the CFTC and the SEC an initial proposal that further defines the concept of a swap execution facility or a security-based swap execution facility. Both CEFs and security-based CEFs are new concepts. They don't exist currently, although they are inspired from existing exchanges and existing contract markets. But they're really a new entity, and so it's up to the regulators to really explain to us how CEFs and security-based CEFs are going to work. Now, the CFTC and the SEC, as I said, have come out with proposals in terms of what will constitute a CEF and security-based CEF, and their proposals look currently very different from each other, which is interesting, to say the least, when you look at a market, for example, like the credit derivatives market or the equity derivatives market, where you have certain index-linked products that are going to be treated as regulated by the CFTC, and certain single name or single equity products being registered regulated by the SEC, and so in a market which to date has been a kind of single market that is now bifurcated between two regulators, having trading, different types of trading venues for those products that are often used to offset each other can create a number of problems. Now, you add to that the fact that it's possible that certain products will migrate to different geographic regions depending upon where the underlying is based. For example, if the underlying equity is traded, the actual cash equity is trading on an exchange in Europe, perhaps the swaps that reference those equities will also trade on platforms that are being set up in Europe. And the question there is whether those platforms that are developed in Europe will be sufficient to satisfy the CFTC and the SEC that they should be considered to be SEFs, and therefore the trading and the swaps on those platforms should be considered to meet the requirement that certain swaps that are clearable be subject to mandatory trading on a SEF or security-based SEF. So there's a number of interesting issues that we still have to iron out, both here at home in terms of the coordination between the CFTC and the SEC, and also then on an international scale as we look further afield and see what the what regulators globally are doing, and whether the CFTC and the SEC or global regulators outside of the U.S. are going to give recognition to the platforms that are set up in those different locations to satisfy each individual jurisdiction's trading requirement.
And David, I would just note that this area of execution facilities is one of the few where there was not at least international consensus on around this being a good idea, right? That we had international consensus by the G20 countries on the idea of clearing, central clearing of swaps and derivatives, but this idea of requiring mandatory execution of swaps on such facilities was not taken up by the G20, and I think this is one area where you may see some significant differences in the end on approach between the U.S. and Europe, although more recently Europe has been making noises about going down the trade execution route.
Yeah, that's right, and it's sort of one area where the Americans over in Europe are getting some bad press at the moment in that, at least people that are active in the markets over in Europe are sort of bemoaning the fact that the U.S. came up with this execution requirement, because initially they didn't expect that it would be part of the European regulations, but slowly we're seeing the influence of the U.S. over in Europe, and the Europeans now coming around to this idea that actually trading on these regulated platforms is perhaps a good idea.
Now, speaking of clearing, let's go into looking at what needs to be clarified on the central clearing via CCP's area. Donna, what's your view on that?
Well, as mentioned, again, there has been broad global consensus that central clearing and mandatory clearing of many types of derivative transactions is something that many countries are going to require. So there is consistency on this theme. I think the issue that then faces market participants is how this is going to work in practice. Section 725H of Dodd-Frank does expressly contemplate that the CFTC can exempt a derivatives clearing organization or a DCO from registration in the U.S. if it's subject to a comparable comprehensive supervision and regulation by appropriate government authorities in the home country of organization. But there does need to be sort of a comparability analysis and determination made. And I think just as a practical matter, the CFTC has so much on their plate right now in terms of finalizing existing rulemakings and dealing with determinations of what products should be mandatorily cleared in the U.S. that to expect any time in the near future them to be able to devote the time and resources to a comparability analysis of a foreign clearing organization is probably going to be difficult just from a resource and priority perspective. So, that then winds up what I think in practical purposes what that means is that you have different CCPs located in different geographies that are going to be complying with potentially different legal regimes. And the one that jumps to my mind is particularly potentially problematic is that, in the U.S., when you post collateral, we have a security interest regime under the UCC. And in Europe, there are many jurisdictions which actually grant the equivalent of a security interest through title transfer, where you actually transfer the underlying ownership of the collateral being posted. and trying to deal with those two different legal models. When, for example, let's say you have a U.S. person and the extraterritorial provisions of Dodd-Frank would say any person accepting money from a U.S. person in connection with swaps activity needs to be registered with an FCM and comply with U.S.-style requirements, will just pose some significant and serious practical problems when perhaps that FCM is located in Europe and there's an entirely different legal regime relating to the posting and transfer of collateral and the client asset protection that those customers are entitled to in the case of a default. Now, I know, you know, David has mentioned to me, and if he wants to speak briefly about it now, that there are some efforts being made to try to both comply with U.S. regimes and European regimes with respect to central clearing.
Yep, that's right. There are certain clearing houses who arguably could have gone through a mutual recognition route by choosing not to register in the U.S. as a DCO, but instead seeking to rely upon a waiver from registration under a kind of mutual recognition regime, but instead register as a DCO. And as sort of connected to that, therefore, any U.S. customer that was seeking to clear on that now U.S. registered DCO need to do through a futures merchant. And so it has been necessary for European clearinghouses to actually change the model for clearing or introduce a model for clearing that will actually allow for FCMs to grant access to the clearing members on behalf of the customers. So we're definitely seeing the influence again of the U.S. outside of the U.S. in terms of what entities are doing, even outside of the U.S. because of the fact that the U.S. requirements have this broad reach.
Okay, thank you. David, now one area I wanted to go into in a little bit of detail is the transaction reporting via the SDRs. Can you give us a brief overview of where you think the interpretations need to be clarified within this reporting area?
Sure. So just before the holidays, the CFTC finalized two rules in the area of reporting. The first one related to the reporting of information to swap data repositories. And then the second one related to the actual public dissemination of certain of that information so that the public actually has access to the information to develop post-trade price transparency. Reporting is also a feature of the European regulations under EMIR, so it's going to be interesting for us to see whether there is going to be, again, mutual recognition of reporting that can take place over in Europe or outside of the U.S., or whether it will be necessary for parties that are entering into swaps that are caught by both Dodd-Frank and the rules of another jurisdiction, whether they will have to dual report, so they'll have to report to a U.S.-registered swap data repository and also report to the non-U.S. data repository in the jurisdiction where they're located. And those issues in particular have yet to be resolved. There are still certain issues relating to the confidentiality of information that that have yet to be resolved, and particularly certain entities that are located in certain jurisdictions and their counterparties may have confidentiality obligations with respect to those counterparties. And so I think we will start to see more provisions in documentation where people are expressly acknowledging the reporting duty of one of the parties and acknowledging that the information that is being reported is not confidential information, so that the parties can actually comply with their reporting duties. But as I say, it sort of remains to be seen as to whether the U.S. is going to give recognition to overseas data repositories, whether the U.S. will be comfortable that if the information is in an overseas data repository that they have sufficient access to it and that they are able to get a fair picture of the positions and the information that they need to access, which may therefore call for some form of global data repository that would presumably be required to comply with all of the regulations of the members that would be submitting the information to the data repository. And I think that is something that people are looking at currently to see whether we can achieve some form of central global location for some of this information.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, David. Now, I'd like to wrap this up by offering both Adonna and David the opportunity to give us really your advice that you would offer any financial institutions about what to expect in the next year or perhaps, what you would like the regulators to really focus on most importantly. Obviously, there's quite a lot to iron out here. But Donna, do you want to give us kind of your advice going forward or expectations going forward?
Sure. I guess I would just want people to understand the influence that the U.S. political process will have on this extraterritorial debate, both in its current state and going forward. In some ways, we've had a lot of talk recently and a lot of focus on the U.S. job market and preserving jobs in the U.S. and trying to bring down unemployment. And how this relates to Dodd-Frank and extraterritoriality is that the rules and regulation as currently proposed in the U.S. are one of the strictest globally. The U.S. has taken the lead in the regulation of the derivatives market. And what that means is unless there is a broad extraterritorial reach by the U.S., there is a very real possibility that market participants and transactions and business, along with the attendant jobs, could move offshore. So in some ways, what remains to be seen, but what may very well play out, is that because of our strict regulation, the CFTC may be compelled to assert jurisdiction over participants in foreign jurisdictions in order to preserve the vitality of the business in the U.S. Now, what you need to keep in mind is that there certainly could be a retaliatory effect by certain governments in Europe and elsewhere, which would be, a terrible thing. And then I think the U.S. election, and to the extent any of these provisions are watered down as a result of the election or otherwise, will again impact, I think, the extraterritoriality provisions of financial regulatory reform. In its best case, these types of provisions and the extraterritoriality reach should really be addressed on some sort of international level, through G20 or the Financial Stability Board, but some sort of intergovernmental agency. But in practice, that remains very, very difficult to do given the political imperatives in each home country jurisdiction.
Thank you, Donna. And David, what's your advice going forward?
Well, I definitely think finally that 2012 is the year that we are going to see some of Dodd-Frank actually apply. And Dodd-Frank was enacted back in 2010, and the expectation was that all of this would be wrapped up within a year, and I think people obviously realized that that was a humongous task for the regulators to take on, and we will those now start to see actual requirements that people will have to be in compliance with. So 2012 is going to be a big year for people to be monitoring developments and getting their houses in order so that they can be compliant. I agree with Donna, though, that the extraterritorial impact of some of these rules is really a very big part of the ability of people to comply, and just knowing which parts of their business they need to have in compliance with these rules is an open question. And therefore, I think people will ultimately, unfortunately, be forced to just take a sensible approach, and we'll be looking at the way that the CFTC uses its new enforcement powers to enforce the requirements that are coming in. We'll be looking at the guidance that the CFTC puts out on extraterritoriality, and those things will sort of influence the way that people will comply. But at the moment, there are a number of, very significant open questions in terms of the scope, and so people will have to take a sensible approach, and I don't think anyone can expect that the regulators are going to give us all the answers ahead of the time that people will have to actually be in formal compliance. And so some of this is going to be a bit of a leap of faith, a bit of a what is reasonable and sensible to do in the circumstances. Obviously, people will want to take a conservative approach, this is something that is going to continue to evolve, I think, over a number of years as we start to figure out the answers and start to slowly get further guidance.
Okay, great. Thank you. So it sounds like, in summary, 2012 is going to be, we should expect some clarification. However, there is much hope for some international coordination, and clearly it's very needed, as Donna pointed out. But as David pointed out, you guys got to keep going and take that leap of faith to get the compliance up and running before time runs out, essentially. So I want to thank Donna and David for joining us today and giving us their very expert insight into this very hot topic of extraterritoriality of Dodd-Frank. For all those listening, thank you for tuning in today, and stay tuned for future podcasts. Thank you.